Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. We are going to talk about Syria in the first part of our program today. We have with us Phyllis Bennis, who is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many books, including In the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer. Omar Hosino is with us. He's an independent researcher who focuses on Syria, writes about the Syrian conflict for Syria deeply, foreign policy and other outlets, recently visited Syria. Dr. Stephen David is professor of political science and vice dean for undergraduate education at Johns Hopkins University. And welcome, everybody. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
So let's just clear one thing out first. I've been reading what both you've been writing, Omar Hosino, what you've been writing, Phyllis Bennis, and know some of what Stephen David is talking about. Let's clear out the kind of surface politics of this. What Republicans and some other stalwarts in Congress are calling for in terms of some kind of intervention, the kind of surface stuff on the top. Because Phyllis Bennis, it really is kind of very narrow. This is not telling us anything about the complexity of what we're facing.
Absolutely. And of course, the danger is we're hearing the same kinds of claims that we heard 10 years ago regarding Iraq, the same claims we heard 2 years ago regarding Libya. And even just yesterday on the Sunday morning shows, we heard from Senator McCain. He even said, oh, no, the worst thing we could do would be to put boots on the ground. But then he goes ahead and talks about securing chemical weapons by sending in some kind of special forces, establishing a no-fly zone. And as we know from Libya, as we know from history, as we know from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the first act in creating a, quote, no-fly zone is an act of war, because the first thing you do is go in and attack all of the anti-aircraft capacity of the country. Syria has a very advanced, very developed anti-aircraft system, and taking it out would be very, very difficult. It would take a long time. There almost certainly would be casualties. And this idea that somehow that's different than, quote, boots on the ground, among other things, when you shoot down your first pilot, you're going to have boots on the ground, and you're going to have more boots who go in to rescue him. So this notion that it can all be done sort of clean and without real boots on the ground, it just isn't true. More important is the similarity that we're seeing to 10 years ago in Iraq, when claims were made about weapons of mass destruction as a justification for a war that was ultimately exposed to be based on lies. And what we're hearing here, we hear that we have differing assessments about the validity of the evidence. The evidence isn't clear. The only evidence that has been made public is some video of a group of patients who showed some symptoms of pupils were dilated and some were foaming at the mouth. And a doctor who, we don't even know who those people were or where they are. It was said that they were in Syria. They may well have been. They may well have been victims of a chemical weapon attack of some sort. But there's so many other possibilities of what could have caused those symptoms, what could have caused the release of sarin. All of these things are not known. And at the end of the day, it's an even-if thing. Even if there was some amount of chemical weapons used, we've had 70,000 people killed in Syria so far. And the idea that sending more weapons to one side to escalate the civil war is somehow going to protect civilians in that country simply boggles the mind. It simply is not the answer. You can't go in and kill more people with conventional weapons in the name of preventing them from being killed with chemical weapons.
That, part of what's going on here is, I think, the press's, the journalism in general, the kind of confusion over what's happening inside the country. The power
Absolutely.
Of groups that are associated with al-Qaeda as opposed to secularists, Assad, kind of boil it down simply to an argument of sectarian war. And Omar Hassina, the piece you wrote, I really found really interesting, because in your latest journey to Syria, because that's what you were reaching for. You were reaching for the complexity. You were trying to see a lot of it through the eyes of some of the very mixed group of, for want of a better term, secularists who are not – your argument is they are not – they are there, as opposed to the New York Times saying that they don't have any power at all. Talk about your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with you. You know, I read that quote in the New York Times that there are no secularists in Syria. I mean, as the months go on, that quote becomes more and more true, but I don't think it's the most accurate thing we can say. You know, the rebel forces in Syria are quite fractured, and not all people in the opposition in Syria are in the rebel forces as well. That's something that needs to be understood. You know, I met with a lot of people from local councils who, you know, started their own court systems, different religious leaders, many of them pushing a narrative that was very anti-sectarian, telling me that sectarianism must be stopped, being worried by the growing tide of sectarianism within the country and within the opposition. I mean, we have to be honest that as the months go on, this al-Qaeda-linked group called Jabhat al-Nusra gets stronger and stronger in the country. However, there are people that are counterweight. I met a religious leader named Sheikh Abul Huda al-Husseini, who told me, you know, there's no crime in Islam to be an Alawite, that Alawites and Sunnis must have equal rights, that even atheists should have a seat at the table in the new Syrian parliament, being given a quota to talk. I met Kurdish fighters who said they were for a secular state, who were against al-Qaeda. And I also met with the nonviolent youth activists. Now, one thing is, you know, in the media, we sometimes believe that, you know, see this revolution or this civil war now in Syria as being just two armed sides fighting each other. However, there's many youth activists and nonviolent protesters who believe that they are part of what would be called the rebels in Syria and who are pushing a very non-sectarian message. Actually, the main youth groups in Syria, the main nonviolent groups in Syria are actually led by Alawites. I met with a woman named Lubna Mur'i, who is an Alawite woman. Her father was killed, her mother was killed by her father since she opposed the Assad regime. And I met with another person who leads a group called Mabub, which sends nonviolent and secular activists to the protest to put signs up in the face of the armed fighters saying, you know, we want peace, we are against fighting the Alawites, there's only two sects in Syria, the sect of the oppressors and the sect of the free men. And I would say that a lot of these people are still there. They're still there on the nonviolent level mostly. But in the armed movement, for sure, the tide, as the months go on, is becoming more and more extreme, more conservative in all of its aspects. But, you know, we must bear in mind, even there are secular groups. There's a battalion I would tell you about called the National Unity Brigade that has decided they want to participate in the armed opposition. And this brigade is led by Druze people. It has women in it, has Shiites, it has Alawites, and it has Christians. Other minorities and most secular activists don't believe in joining the armed movement at the time, but this is one example of a brigade that is there. However, I would say they are marginal and they are small, and as the months go on, they become more and more irrelevant in the country, unfortunately.
Irrelevant. That's sad to hear. Stephen David, I know part of your take is one of the reasons America should not get involved is because floating arms to Syria would be a disaster in the long run.
Well, I mean, we have to be careful. I mean, if we send, for example, shoulder-held ground-to-air weapons to groups who are associated with al-Qaeda, they can wind up next to American airports shooting down civilian airliners. So we do have to be careful. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't get involved. I mean, I disagree with a lot of the remarks that Phyllis Bennis mentioned. I mean, this isn't Iraq. I don't know anyone who doesn't accept the notion that Syria does have chemical weapons. I mean, there might be some dispute as to whether they use them, how much they use them, but clearly they have chemical weapons, whereas Iraq, it turned out, did not have weapons of mass destruction. Plus, I don't know anyone who wants to launch a major invasion into Syria. That simply not politically acceptable. We don't have the money to do it. We don't have the will to do it. It's not going to happen. I think the real question is what we can do to protect civilians in Syria who 70,000, 80,000 have died. And sometimes that does take force. But I recognize this is a very complicated, difficult issue. Can you get arms and protection to groups who are not extreme Islamists, who are reasonably moderate, and who won't turn those weapons against us? And I don't know, but I don't think the answer is to simply throw up our hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do, and just let people continue to die.
I mean, so right. Where is, and Phyllis, I'll let you jump right in here, but so where is the ground in terms of policy and what the West should do? You know, people, A, you've got examples like Rwanda, where nobody did anything and genocide did take place. B, you've got examples like Iraq, where the United States have been in on completely false reasons and tore country asunder, and we have the results. I mean, and you have the people in Congress, whether it's Saxby on the Republican side or the many Democrats who are saying we may just have to intervene at some level militarily. So it's kind of a frightening kind of situation because I think people are groping, don't have an answer, Phyllis Bettis.
I think part of the problem is we've had such a long history in this country of assuming that our engagement, that our intervention is always military, that we either invade militarily, intervene militarily, go in militarily, or we do nothing, we throw up our hands. Those aren't the only options. The militarization of our foreign policy overall has been a huge crisis over these last years. The flooding of money to the Pentagon vis-a-vis the cutbacks in money to the State Department is only one reflection of that. What we need to do is engage in the kind of serious diplomacy that we have not been willing to do. So, for example, you hear demands for UN inspections on the question of whether or not there are chemical weapons coming from both sides. The regime in Syria has said they want a UN inspection team, but only with a very narrow mandate that would only be allowed to investigate whether the opposition, whether the rebels used chemical weapons. The U.S. is now saying they would be open to some kind of a UN mandate, but I can be pretty sure that they will want a mandate that's equally narrow on the other side, that only wants to investigate whether there has been the use of chemical weapons by the regime. What we really need is a massive, wide-ranging mandate to investigate any chemical weapons use, and it needs to be put into the context of the region, which right now is exploding with increasing violence. The five separate wars that are being waged right now in Syria, and I really appreciate Omar's focus on the complexity of the internal situation, there are five separate wars that are both internal, regional, and global, all of which are being fought in the context of the war in Syria. We need to put this back in that regional context. There is an existing UN resolution going back to 1991, the resolution that ended the war in Iraq at that time, Resolution 687, whose Article 14 called for the creation of a Middle East zone free of all weapons of mass destruction. No exception. So that would include, and was meant to include, Syria's chemical weapons. It's true, there's little opposition to the idea that Syria historically has had chemical weapons. Other countries in the region have as well. Israel has nuclear weapons. Iran, nobody wants to get nuclear weapons. All of that would be dealt with in the context of a Middle East free of all weapons of mass destruction. The beginning for that could be in Security Council resolutions where the negotiations would go on between supporters of the two sides, the U.S., the Brits, and the French on the one hand, representing the interests, they think, of the armed opposition. I agree they don't represent the original democratic nonviolent opposition. And the Russians, on the other hand, representing the interests of the regime. If there could be that kind of negotiation, it could lead to a de-escalation in the continued arming of the two sides in Syria that is throwing the rest of the region into such chaos.
Omar, and then Stephen, I mean, your takes, and Anthony, please come in.
I keep trying, but you keep talking.
Oh, is that the problem?
No, I'm joking.
but please, Omar and Stephen, I'm curious about what you think these policy options are. I mean, even through the UN, you know, Russia or China will veto whatever happens in the Security Council, for sure, since they're allies. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what do you both think this is the place we go?
Well, I'm not going to make any direct policy recommendations, only to say, you know, every option has major trade-offs, you know, pros and cons and risks that go along with it, and that, you know, decision makers are going to have to thoroughly think through all the different options. Phyllis mentioned a deal with the Russians, and many strands of the Syrian opposition have said that that's what they would like to have, and that, you know, this should be pursued. You know, the president met with Putin in July 2012 in Mexico at the G20 summit, where they discussed Syria trying to do a deal. Unfortunately, those talks failed when attempted. A week later, they did the Geneva Accord to try for a transition, you know, based on both countries supporting a transition of Assad from power peacefully through negotiations. Till this date, this has failed. John Kerry 2 weeks ago stated that he would like to try to revive that. And the president himself today spoke with President Putin, and they discussed Syria and the attempts to try to revive the Geneva Accord there. Others say, however, that, you know, this has been proven to fail for the past year and a half, that it hasn't worked, and advocate a more hawkish response. You know, we had the head of the CIA, we had Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, we had the Defense Secretary Leon Panetta at the time, all advocate this idea of arming the rebels in around August of 2012, after attempts for a deal with the Russians didn't have headway. The president rejected this option. And, you know, the conflict in Syria continues to move on with all these different options on the table. The conflict continues to go on. Now, we've had over 70,000 people killed. Chemical weapons perhaps were used. And ever since July of 2012, after these options had not worked, now we have the a growing emergence of al-Qaeda in Syria. You know, last summer, for those of us watching, the al-Qaeda in Syria were not the strongest presence on the ground. They only had declared themselves in January of 2012. But the reports that we get coming out of Syria every month say that they're getting stronger and stronger. And only last week, they pledged allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri. So it looks likely that as the months go on, al-Qaeda in Syria will get stronger. Now, what's the response to that? What should policymakers do, whether it should be arming or the deal with the Russians or some sort of diplomatic situation? Each has its trade-offs and pros and cons, for sure.
Stephen?
Well, I think if you believe that the UN can resolve this diplomatically, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn I'd love to sell. I mean, when I think of the UN and humanitarian involvement, I think of Srebrenica, where 7,000-8,000 young Muslim men were slaughtered while under the supposed protection of the UN. I think Syrian civilians would be crazy, anyone would be crazy, to put their fate in the hands of the United Nations. I mean, let's also come back a little to the United States. Let's not forget that our president, Obama, said that if the Syrians used chemical weapons, it would be a red line. It would be a game changer. It would promote some kind of American involvement. Not to do anything just on this political credibility grounds alone is going to cause repercussions. I mean, a president can't get up and publicly say, you better not do this, and someone does it, and then he says, never mind. Now, again, what to do is a difficult thing, but it seems to me there are ways of minimizing American risks, minimizing American casualties, and still getting involved in a manner, perhaps a no-fly zone, perhaps aid to the refugees, perhaps making sure that Syrian planes and aircraft don't attack defenseless civilians, that can be done at a small risk to the United States that may reap tremendous benefits on the ground for the innocent civilians. That's where I think we have to look.
If I could add something about the humanitarian aid and something that should definitely be considered, you know, there's a 1991 UN General Assembly resolution which prohibits the entry of humanitarian aid without the permission of the government. And this is what Valerie Amos at the United Nations has cited several times. And this has prohibited UN direct aid to the northern regions where we have the rebels operating. And these regions are getting worse off and worse off. The poverty is getting horrible. The situation is very hard. and the radical Al-Qaeda terrorists are coming in, and they are taking advantage of this vacuum, giving people aid, being seen as less corrupt, and getting stronger and stronger. I do believe some sort of push at the UN to allow for aid shipments to be shipped across the northern border to rebel-held areas, and even some sort of agreement with the regime, should definitely be considered. Just 2 months ago, when the United Nations attempted to send aid just 30 kilometers into the Syrian border to Azaz, they had to fly them into regime-held territory 3 hours away and then drive them 5 hours until they could reach their destination. I do believe that the humanitarian situation on the ground is not helpful for anyone, not for the Syrian people, not for the United States, not for Russia or Assad, for that matter. The situation is crumbling and creating this vacuum for radical groups to take advantage.
And Phyllis?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that the question of support for humanitarian efforts is crucial. It needs to go to the countries in the surrounding area as well as inside, on all sides. And again, you can talk about Srebrenica all you want, but the only place where there is a potential for serious negotiations right now is in the United Nations. I mean, we can also use the example of Rwanda, when the United Nations was prevented from playing a role in stopping the genocide at the demand of its commander on the ground, prevented by the British and the French and the U.S. That wasn't something that the UN, in some independent role, did. The question of U.S. domination of the United Nations is an old story.
But let's talk about Rwanda. I mean, the genocide only ended not through the involvement of international institutions, but through a military, Paul Kagame, that has finally ended the slaughter that was taking place while the world and the UN looked the other way.
No, the UN didn't look the other way. It was the United States and the French who first demanded that the UN not engage, and then the French went in with Operation Turquoise to have control of it on their own. So we should be very clear about what prevented UN direct engagement 3 months earlier.
And we should be very clear that sometimes it takes armed intervention to stop the slaughter of innocents.
On occasion it does. It's very rare, and this is not one of them, because this one is going to mean a huge escalation. The notion that we could have... comparing, for example, humanitarian aid increase, which I absolutely agree with, and we need to figure out a way to make that happen, but comparing that to, we could do that, or we could try for a no-fly zone, or we could try not to let the planes fly, those are direct military interventions which will lead to a massive escalation in Syria, in the surrounding countries, and in the region. You know, we have already a divide, a power struggle going on in the region between essentially Iran and Saudi Arabia on the one hand, the involvement of a bloc of countries with Syria, Iraq, and Iran on the one hand, opposing the Saudis, the UAE, Qatar, Turkey, another bloc. That power struggle is underway. The power struggle between Russia and the United States over their military bases and naval bases in the region, all of those are underway and being played out in Syria. So greater escalation of the arms being sent in, or certainly of the arms being used by outside powers, is not going to protect civilians. It's going to make it worse.
Well, giving food and medicine to people is something I strongly support, but it's not enough. Food and medicine is not going to prevent air attacks. It's not going to prevent armor attacks. It's not going
to
protect people who don't have other means to protect themselves. Now, I acknowledge this is a very difficult issue, because a lot of the people who are insurgents are not the kind of people we want to arm.
And
it's a real empirical question whether there are groups there who are reasonable enough to get American support.
Well, I think on that note, we have to end this discussion just for today, and we invite you all to come back. So I think we're leaving off at a point where we should pick up, which would be a discussion on if is military intervention ever justified? Can it be justified in situations as complex as this? Is there really any way around and through this, given what has happened with Iraq and the rest? And we'll come back to that, and I really appreciate the time the three of you have given our listeners. Dr. Stephen David, Phyllis Bennis, and Omar Hassino, I appreciate all the work that you do, and I appreciate you being a guest on our show today.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Many thanks.
We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to come home, so to speak, and talk about Prince George's County and the executive takeover of their public school system, what that means, both from a reporter's point of view and then from people who have different opinions on that issue and yours at 410-319-8888, especially our listeners down over in Prince George's County.